Jeremy was born in Kenya, of third generation Kenyan farmers. In the 1950s over there, he was a member of the British Territorial Horses during the Mau Mau emergency. He first of all was in the infantry, then the mounted police, and then in field intelligence with the special branch. I suppose that involved firstly a lot of walking, then a lot of riding, and then a lot of thinking. And he's certainly done that ever since. In 1962, it was our pleasure in Australia to have Jeremy come over here. And in 1967, he started full-time lecturing. He was full-time with the League of Rights, lecturing and organizing until 1988, when he became a freelancer. Jeremy gives about 150 talks every year. And he's had 3 tours of Canada. He's had 13 tours of New Zealand. And he has toured Britain, both North and South Island, and has done too many tours around Australia that anyone could possibly count. Since 1991, Jeremy has majored on the New World Order and related subjects, certainly an important one to us all. He's had 5 videos published on the New World Order, and they've sold in their tens of thousands. He's written many books, as we know, including some recent books. I know of no one in Australia who can explain crucial issues as simply as Jeremy can, nor use the establishment evidence to show that what he's saying is absolutely correct. Now, many people have said that when Jeremy was born, they broke the mold. But fortunately, I know that's not true. We have the mold. We've got some DNA, and we're actually going to clone 100 Jeremy Lees and having campaigning around Australia on our behalf. Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Jeremy Lee. Speaking on Jim Potential.
Thank you, Dennis. 100 Jeremy Lees clone, good Lord. All in black bras, dear, oh dear. Can I just say to begin with how deeply devastated I was, together with all my fellow men here, at some of the disparaging remarks made earlier about a particular sex, and I now know why it is that women are such an extraordinary species. Having tried to force myself last night into what they wear, and to understand the restrictions it obviously places on their brains, I can see. Reminds me of that story. Some of you may have heard it about Adam and Eve. Adam went to the Lord, and just after he'd been given a companion, you see, and he said to the Lord, "Lord, I really appreciate this creature you've given me to be my companion. But there are one or two questions I'd like to ask." He said, "Why did you make her so beautiful?" And the Lord said, "Well, so that you would love her." "Yeah, but I mean, why did you give her such long golden tresses that shimmers in the moonlight?" And the Lord said, "So you would love her." "And why did you give her all those glorious curves?" The Lord said, "So you would love her." "But if that's the case, Lord, why did you make her so dumb?" The Lord said, "So she would love you." This is now my 38th year since I started speaking, and I've watched the evolution of this. I've watched meetings like this all around Australia, and I've watched all the different things we've tried to do, and it does seem to me that we have got to do some very quick thinking and learning, because we are repeating mistake after mistake after mistake. And one of the reasons for that is because we have compartmentalized Australian history. There is a whole history of the formation of this country at Federation. There's a history of the country in that awful, well, there's obviously a history of this country in the war period, but there's also a unique history of Australia during the Depression, where they did every single thing that we're doing now, and they learnt many lessons out of that and made many mistakes, and they'd actually got much further during the Depression than we've got now. They were dealing with the banking question. They were dealing with government and how you get your members of parliament to be representative and the danger of parties. All that is not new now. It was happening in the 30s. And they had some great leaders. They had better politicians then than we've got now. They had a few statesmen sprinkled amongst them. They had huge movements. Do you know that there was over 250 groups during the Depression meeting every Wednesday or Thursday night in Sydney to discuss what was going on, just in Sydney alone? The main paper of what you'd call the conservative freedom movement was a paper called The New Era, which had 35,000 subscribing members. Here we are trying to scratch a living out of its time and the strategy, and they can hardly cover their costs. They had huge debates with economists and members of parliament, because there was no television then, and the politicians had to come and meet the people face to face. And the arguments we're still going on with. Somebody here was talking about creating more jobs. What a disaster. It's not the role of government to create jobs. We ought to be trying to release people out of jobs if we had the right money system. Have you ever thought of that? We had a conference back in 1995, that's only 7 years ago, in San Francisco, where all the great economists and bankers and politicians in the world met to discuss one problem. And that problem was this. We can now run the world, they said, with the technology we've got, and produce everything that is needed for the whole of mankind with about 20% of the existing workforce. We could have 80% unemployment right across the world, and we could still produce everything that's needed. Why does anybody want to create more jobs in that situation? Think about that. Because every time Tony Abbott comes out and says, if you haven't got a job, it's work for the dole, he's denying the facts of history. We have reached a totally new era. We don't need everybody working. We need people to be freed from work into full-time, self-chosen activities. But what's got to be done is to provide an income for them to be able to do that. And that income can't come from taxes, because we've only got 20% left to tax. We're going to go to the 2080 society. We've got to force the banks to release the income that doesn't belong to them, which has come through the result of our heritage and should be available to everybody, whether they're working or not. We are at the edge of the greatest disaster that has ever faced mankind. But locked into this disaster are the seeds of a breakthrough into a world of such abundance and peace that none of us can even imagine it. And what we've got to do is, first of all, get a picture, a vision of what it is we want, and then we've got to know what we've got to do to get it. And the first lesson is, you cannot get it by trying to get into power yourself, because it is not a power game. And I've watched time after time people talking about starting new parties, or forming new alliances, or standing against the existing establishment, and we're going to win, and because we're better than they are, we're going to put the right answers in place. They learnt about that during the Depression. The parties that were started during the Depression to stop this growing understanding and revolt were started by these other parties. And when people began to split up into different parties, all fighting each other to get into parliament, they breathed a sigh of relief. They knew the whole thing was finished. Two people have talked at this seminar about property rights. Property rights has got enough steam in it to grab the whole of Australia if we can present this right. They're holding a big forum in Mackay in 3 months' time, and the title is Property Rights. Not just an abstract, but what's happening to your farm and your business and your home. And I'll tell you, they'll get somewhere. But if you wanted to stop that conference, what would you do? You'd start a new property rights party. And immediately the whole lot would be split up and they'd go home and be finished. Parties and power movements in this situation are a disaster. Now that is not to knock Pauline Hanson. I think she had tremendous courage, but it was the wrong answer. And the evidence of that is what happened once they got some power. And the fact that they were amenable to infiltration. And the fact they could get one person arguing against another person. And the fact that when it came to handing out votes at how to vote time, in my case, I was supporting Graham Campbell, I find myself standing next to a One Nation person and we're both trying to get opposite candidates in. I'll never do it again. Never. Because when I talk to that person who was handing out how to vote cards for a totally different person than what I was, we both absolutely agreed. Why were we in opposing camps fighting each other? Because we got sucked into that stupid power game. We can get into power and we're going to impose the right answer on the people. Whether the people understand it or not, we're going to do good to you whether you like it or not. That really is the person in the whole of this game. It's the same temptation that went before Adam. You can be as gods. You can produce the right answers. You can make everybody else happy. Hitler had it. Stalin, well, he was a madman. Perhaps he didn't, but he studied that way. Every politician here thinks they want to be loved. Bob Hawke was the epitome of wanting to be loved. He was a disaster himself. He used to go round and he'd find any group he could put his arms round and have a grog with, just so he could be popular. And his eternal sorrow, there are no statues of Bob Hawke so far anywhere in Australia. What a tragedy. Because the pigeons are still flying around wondering where to perch. I admire the people who've got the will to have a go. Don't get me wrong. But unless they've got knowledge, they are menace. I was rung up just before the last federal election by somebody, it's last state election, somebody on fire, right up North Queensland, to stand for One Nation. This was a disastrous situation. Yes, I agree. Freedom's being wrecked. Boy, did I agree with that. We're all confused. Yes, I'm going to stand for Parliament. What should be my first action? I said, well, have you read the Constitution? Never heard of it. Seriously, he was going to be a One Nation candidate. I'm sorry to tell you this, but he hadn't even read the Constitution. He wouldn't have even understood the argument between Kerry and Joe that we had earlier because he'd never even heard of the damn thing. Now, how could you get people claiming to get into power to save us against a world disaster which is bigger than anything that's ever been seen and they haven't read the Constitution of their own country? It's just fantastic. Then, in my own state seat, this last election, up in just north of Toowoomba where I am, we did a lot of work and we elected an independent candidate. Young dairy farmer, on fire, dairy industries. I'm going to stand against these crook parties. Where is he now? He's joined the very party he was condemning. They offered him a shadow ministry. It's going to be a deep, dark shadow because that party's not going to get back into office for a long time. But just for a little crumb, he sold out all the people who believed that independence were a good thing and he's now back in the party. And he comes round and wants to be loved. It's not going to work. Without knocking him in the slightest, I'll give you another example, and that's the man who spoke here at the last election, Selwyn Johnson. He's a bright boy, Selwyn, top computer man, got an instinct for what's going on, and he moved down from North Queensland into Pauline Hanson's old seat. If she could get 39% of the primary votes, he reckoned he could do it. And he spent 2 years and a huge amount of money on his campaign. And he did it very, very well. Had a team of 80 volunteers, people like you and me, used to meet regularly, put our money in, try and get his signs around, let people know where he was. He went to every meeting that was going on. He had a huge billboard on the back of his truck, Selwyn Johnson, the independent candidate. What did he do? He got less votes than the guy up at the top who didn't run one campaign meeting during the whole election. He might just as well not have been there. I was very sorry for him, but it's a hard lesson. The only chance anybody's got to be of being an independent is to be very, very well known publicly before he even tried. Somebody like Ted Mack in Sydney, who's been a mayor of a major council and has spoken out and has, his face has been in front of the public for 10 years, he might make it. He did make it. And even then, when he was in there, what did he say? You can't do anything in here. I'm going to get out again. Dead honest. He got out just before his superannuation came through. Now, there's honesty for you. So let's give away this idea. We're going to build a team of people and we're going to sweep our candidates in and we're going to rectify Australia because we're just kidding ourselves. And the sooner we face it, the better. And if it hurts a few feelings, I'm sorry about it, but it's the truth. And my job is to try and get through to you the truth. Confederate Action Party. Tremendous people in there. What a disaster. They actually ended up having fist fights at one stage, as far as I understand, between their own people. They hadn't even got into power at that stage. I remember working earlier. I thought perhaps we could get some good men into Parliament to try and support a new young independent. Well, he wasn't an independent. He was a young Liberal, but he was a brilliant bloke, a fellow called Jim Killen. And we worked like steam to get Jim Killen in there, and he used to come and give papers at the League of Rights seminar. He'd be terribly embarrassed if this was publicised, on the nature of our faith and the relationship between Christianity and the social order. And we've still got some of those booklets he wrote lying around. And he got in there, and as soon as he was in there, he was gone. Well, I can't do anything as a backbencher, but I promise you, if I become a minister, that's the time I'm going to speak up. And the last time I ever, ever heard Jim Killen speak personally was at a huge rally down in Melbourne on the question of Rhodesia. Should we take sanctions against Rhodesia or not? And he thundered to his audience, I don't care what my salary is, I will stand or fall on Rhodesia. And huge cheers came back as we thought about our kinsmen over in that country. Did he ever take a stand? No, never. So you can't tell if a person is going to be any good or not before an election. It's always got to be afterwards. So how are you going to pick them before? I remember a man, I was invited in 1971 to go and give evidence before the Country Party, the managed committee of the Great Country Party, which was quite something in those days back in Brisbane, on how to save the family farm. And my job was to try and present some ideas, the first of which was you've got to have long-term, low-interest credit for farmers. You can't go charging them 5, 6, and 7%. It's got to be 2 or 3, and that's it. And they've got to know where they are if you want to keep your family farm. And I was halfway through my speech, and a man got up in the management committee. There were about 40 of them there. And attacked me bitterly. This is funny money stuff, and you're going to start creating credit. We heard all this during the Depression. The Country Party will be discredited if it has people like Jeremy Lee coming here. And I shouted at him because I thought he was an idiot. And it got so heated that the chairman, Bob Sparks, broke it all up, and we went and had lunch. And this guy comes across to me, says, come outside and have a beer. Once everybody left the room. We walked out of that hall where the management committee was across the street into the pub, and we sat down, he bought a beer, and he said, of course, you're absolutely right. But he said, you know, we can't do that. Where do you think we borrow the money for our party from? Who do you think endorses all our campaigns? We can touch the money question, the media would crucify us. We went inside again. I nearly fell off the bar stool. I spilt my beer. We went back into the conference at 2 o'clock, and the same guy who'd bought me the beer got up and attacked me again. Oh, this is all rubbish, this funny new stuff, and trying to discredit the banks. They're our greatest ally and all this stuff. His name was Charles Adam, and he was the Federal Minister for Agriculture. Shortly afterwards, he got his knighthood, Sir Charles, retired from politics. Once he was retired, he was on my side again. I was producing a paper at the time called Queensland Calling in early 1970. One or two of you might remember it. And he became a patron of that paper and began to write articles on the evils of usury. And that same guy, even when he was in politics, every Sunday morning in Kingaroy had given a one-hour Sunday school broadcast for kids. He did it for 60 years on the essence of truth and standing for integrity and all that stuff. What we're dealing with is not a logical problem, it is a power problem and the corruption of mankind. That's what we're dealing with. Anybody hear about a bloke called Jack McEwen? He was a former Prime Minister of Australia. Jack McEwen got into power as a young returned soldier with the backside out of his pants just after the war. And who was in charge of his campaign? A guy called Eric Butler. Eric Butler from the hated, fascist, Nazi, anti-Semitic, racist League of Rights. And Jack McEwen understood the whole social credit money question right down to the ground. And as soon as I get in there, I will stand up and fight. 6 months afterwards, he was called back to a meeting of the people who'd supported him and he told them, I've seen the light. Well, he hadn't seen the light, he'd seen the darkness. That's what he'd really seen, and he'd felt its shadow on him. We've really got problems. One of the most notable leaders in our milieu, if you'd like to use that word, is a guy called Arthur Cresby. Great brain, tremendous insights. He sat with C.H. Douglas on Sydney Harbour during the Depression discussing all this stuff. Finally became a Liberal in Parliament, and he wrote reams of stuff about how you can't do anything inside the power structure. And the first reaction of people is, well, oh, fair enough. Well, I mean, if it can't be done in our parliaments, there's no hope. That's the end of it, isn't it? Because if we can't get our parliament to change, nothing's going to happen. But it went on from there. Nothing will change in parliament until the change has occurred amongst the people first. It doesn't happen the other way around. It doesn't come from parliament down to the people. It goes from regeneration, a rebirth of faith, a reorganization, a recommitment amongst people. And we haven't reached that stage yet. We haven't reached that stage. Even in this room, there are people who only come to listen. They're not committed. They wouldn't give away their homes for Australia. They wouldn't give away their bank account for Australia. We might have to get to that point, because it's happened time and time in history. Where are your final objectives? A very well-known journalist wrote 45 years ago these words, profound stuff. What is left of our civilization will not be maintained. What has been wrecked will not be restored by imagining that some new political gadget can be invented, some new political formula improvised, which will save it. Our civilization can be maintained and restored only by remembering and rediscovering the truths and by reestablishing the virtuous habits on which it was founded. There is no use looking into the blank future for some new and fancy revelation of what man needs in order to live. The revelation has been made. By it, man conquered the jungle about him and the barbarian within him. The elementary principles of work and sacrifice and duty and the transcendent criteria of truth, justice, and righteousness, a grace of love and charity, are the things that have made men free. Men can keep their freedom and reconquer it only by these means. These are the terms stipulated in the nature of things for the salvation of men on this earth, and only in this profound, this stern and tested wisdom shall we find once more the light and courage that we need. In other words, if it is to be a restoration or a regeneration that remotivates Australia, it's got a number of things to go through. The first thing is it's got to be spiritual. Now, we all of us are nominal Christians. We go contentedly to our churches and we say, yes, we've got to stick by the good book, and we churn out the Ten Commandments now and again, and we talk about our Lord, but when it actually comes to putting foot on the ground and getting a bloody nose and getting yourself dirty, people don't like that at all. So we like to keep Christianity, if we're going to use that. There are many examples. Christianity is only one. It's a nice, safe, uncontroversial arena. And we don't rock the boat in church, and we don't sort of denigrate the minister, and we just keep it nice and safe. It is an absolute aberration on true faith to do that. Far better to be thrown out of your church in disgrace for standing for the truth than to stay in there and keep quiet. That's the first thing. The second thing is we have got to build on an association of people who agree on the principles. And that idea of a spiritual faith is enshrined in our constitutional arrangements. And therefore, I've got to be honest in saying, in that debate that on this morning, I'm with Kerry. I do not believe you can say, well, this one isn't working, the judges have destroyed it, everything's been ripped up, the Queen's not signing the right documents, and a whole lot of other things. Let's throw that out and we'll have an absolutely new one that'll be shiny clean. That's the first thing. We've got to stick with the Constitution. But we can't do that unless we've got a group of people who know what the Constitution is and what it's about. So we have built this thing called Freedom Potentials. It's a training school that simply starts at simple, basic ideas about the Constitution. What it is, have you read it? This is what it says, and this is how we've got to safeguard the thing. It is built on a series of principles in which all leaders are servants, unique in our history. And we're going to run this. Not only are we running it, we actually built it 10 years ago, and we've improved it immensely. We've got to find presenters in different areas that are prepared to do it. We want to do it in little groups of more than 15 to 20 people, in a private home or a hotel room. And they do 2 days of intense training, and at least by the end of that, they're going to know what side they're on. How many people here have read the Constitution? How many people haven't? Now, isn't that interesting? All the men put their hands up for the first. Most people have never heard of the Constitution. We've got to do it cheaply enough so that as many people as want to do it can do it, but we can't run it for nothing. We put this thing together. It's on videos. We're going to have training programs for presenters, a 2-day training program. We're not going to let anybody do it because obviously you debase the thing immediately, but there are many people out here capable of being teachers if they've got the right equipment to do it with. And I'm challenging you to go and talk to the little number. We had 18 people did Freedom Potentials 2 days before. Find out what they thought of it because they were very moved. And we've got, I think, 3 people who want to train out of that. They will be equipped with the videos and the right material. All they've got to do is get that 15 or 20 people together. We've got to do this very, very quickly. And there are many people here could do it. So Freedom Potentials is going to do that. And then we've got to link those people together. So one paper, that's It's Time by Ray Smythe, has said, we will give you a free page every issue just to give the news of those who have gone through this course and what they're going to do. And then the third stage is we've got to take all that growing number of people and we've got to focus them in on one thing at a time. Whether it is property rights, let's all work on this one. Whether it's trying to get our jury system back, let's work on that one. Because I will tell you, with the greatest respect to John Wilson and others who are doing single-handedly what we should all be doing, you're not going to win it on your own. One person in a court is not going to win in the end, unless we have built a sea in which that person can swim. And if we don't do this very quickly, we might as well give our country away. You'll find on the table outside there some stuff on Freedom Potentials, and if you want to know any more knowledge and how you want to do it, we can. If you've got a group of people in anywhere you like, Kyogle or Kempsey or Bogabilla or Palamalawa, and you say, look, we can get 15 people together in a house, we'll come and we'll run that program for you. It might not necessarily be myself, but it might be a presenter that we have trained to do this job. And we want to do this in every area, in every state, as soon as we possibly can. And last but not least, none of this is going to work unless we really start taking seriously the point at which Christianity, or any other faith, if you like to mention it, changes from being a theory, an academic theory with a lot of good arguments and some very good theology and some marvelous, read the Beatitudes. You couldn't get anything better. Where it changes from that to being a question of one issue. Is it actually alive and does it change things? Has it changed anything in my life? Can it change things around? And that's where the rubber hits the road. If you haven't reached that point, you haven't reached it. If we're going to get this country back, we've got to have a praying, acting community. We've got to reach 5%. And that 5% will be decisive about whether Australia lives or dies. And I want to finish by telling you that this environment in which we hold the Inverell Forum is going to end very soon. We've only got to have what should already have occurred, a repeat of Argentina in Australia. Because if you want to be honest, have a look at our figures compared to Argentina's figures, and ours are worse. It's only that they haven't pulled plug quite yet, but we're going to reach a stage of absolute chaos. And the man or woman here who has endeavored to equip themselves with the attributes of leadership will be absolutely decisive at that point, because many, many people will be looking for answers. The gun, violence, or a return to truth and principle. Faith is what's going to change things in the end, and I want to finish with a story on faith. Faith is the story of a man who is going to go out across a rope over the famous Niagara Falls that somebody was talking about a bit earlier. Not only was he going to walk across this rope over a thunderous waterfall, but he was going to wheel a wheelbarrow in front of him. And everybody in Canada in that area had heard about it. And they came out, mainly because they thought it would be a big splash when he fell off. They didn't think he could do it. And they watched this minute figure walking along this rope across Niagara, pushing this wheelbarrow, right to the end, and he turned round and he came back to where this great group was waiting on the shore with their mouths wide open. And he said, "Now do you believe I can do it?" And they said, "Yes." "Do you think I could do it again?" "Yes." "Well, who's coming to sit in the wheelbarrow?"
Ladies and gentlemen, you can ask your questions of Jeremy now. And once again, let's thank Jeremy for a superb presentation on what we should do.
Yes, Jeremy. Seeing you rated me for wanting to create jobs for everyone, and I regard jobs as one of human pleasures. You also stated in the report from the well-known journalist, you stated that unless we the work ethic, why's the difference?
Ah.
You're working every day. I notice you.
There is a vast difference between the work ethic and having a job. You may have been very lucky to have a job that was creative and suited your talents that you enjoyed. But for every one person like you, we are pushing into dead-end, destructive jobs, people who are not suited for what they're doing. And that is the result of creating jobs. Out of the number of jobs we've got in Australia, I would say about 10 to 12% are genuinely creative, good jobs. The rest are designing ID cards or forms to fill in or anything of that nature, which has got nothing to do with what you'd call work. Now, the next question is, we've got to go on to what is the difference between work and leisure. Leisure is the thing out of which every civilization has grown, because leisure is the most creative period of your life. The great cathedrals in England were built in leisure time. There wasn't a penny paid in wages for them. There were no unions, job creation, anything else. People just got together for the hell of it because they wanted to build something heavenly. So what we want is release of human beings into a form of activity which they personally can choose. And if you go along with that, I'll go along with you. But what we're doing is creating activities which are destructive, quite often polluting, and which are not suited to that person with all their God-given talents.
Thank you, Jeremy. The rest of my paper,
Thank you. Yes, question please, sir.
Jeremy, could I take you back to one of your earlier videos called The Drive for World Control?
Yes.
And part of that you said that as a result, I don't know what, but the whole world was in debt to the tune of about $12.5 trillion. Who was it to? Was it to the moon? Have you worked out how that came about and to whom it is owed?
The money is owed to a small group of international bankers who've taken control of something that is illicit and is not theirs, and that is the right to create our credit against our efforts. And I think an awful lot of people understand that now. The question is not who is it, it's how the heck are we going to beat them over the head. I might add, there was a quote the other day that out of that book of Professor R.T. Naylor, Hot Money, in which he said this: having put the whole of world trade onto a computer, for the first time at the end of the 80s, a model came out that was horrific. The world is now running a balance of payments deficit with itself, And at that time, it was $100 billion a year. And he asked the IMF, how could it be? How could all this trade result in the world going deeper into debt? And they said, we know it's happening. We can't explain it. We put it under the heading of asymmetries. And sarcastically, he asked in his book, well, the moon must now have a balance of payments surplus then.
Thank you. Yes, your question, please.
Yeah, Jeremy, you mentioned that you don't see a solution through changing the political order in this country, at least through political parties. And you know I'm involved in political parties. The issue I'm really getting at is the only people who can break the power of either media or the courts or any of the other groups which are constraining society is, in fact, the politicians. Yet if you don't get into the parliamentary bear pit and contest with them, you'll never be able to change the courts or the media. And I'm in favour of changing the courts and the media dramatically.
And
but you can't
Jeremy's
do it.
Comment.
So I would like Jeremy's comment as to how you can change the others without getting to the bar.
I take your point. It can only be changed through parliamentary process, whatever it is, but it's not going to be done by getting new candidates to replace old. Now, it is quite feasible that if you had an axe over the backs of their neck, the Howard Coalition would produce everything you wanted. And if you want proof of that, just go and have a look at how King John changed his policies when the barons had their axe neck. What was it made John Howard suddenly come out on the refugee crisis? It was Pauline Hanson. But Pauline Hanson did have to get into power to change John Howard's policies. She just waved them around, and she waved them around so that John Howard got the message. If we could produce a movement of people who can wave enough flags, the existing politicians will do the job. They're no worse than the mob we're trying to get in, I'll tell you that. It's just that they've been bought. Until you have got regeneration amongst the people, you cannot have changes in Parliament. It happens in that order. And that's why if Pauline Hanson had swept into power, we'd have an even bigger disaster on our hands at the moment. Because she would have been assassinated or poisoned or intimidated or bought off, and all her mates would have been bought off with her, and we'd been back where we started. The regeneration has to come amongst the people first.